Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks everyone for coming, and thanks especially to Gifre for making it possible for us to be here. We had a very good 3 weeks, and this is my last week here. So today I'm going to be talking about twist fields. Actually, we heard a talk by Dr. Gaiotto earlier, I mean 2 weeks ago, I think, about in particular examples of those fields, disorder fields. So fields that have a branch cut attached to them and have special properties in QFT. And today I'm going to talk about two families of such fields that happen to play a role in two very different setups. One field is in the field of entanglement measures, and another one is in the context of string theory. So some of the talk is going to feel very basic, given the talk that we had before, but perhaps it's not that bad, given that it's the second one, and maybe you're a little tired. So I'm going to review a few things, and before, I'm going to tell you about a couple of references in case you find this interesting and want to read more about it. So the first paper we actually wrote about this topic is already 10 years old. It's from, well, we wrote it in 2007. It was published in 2008. But it's still actually, I think, probably the best reference if you never heard of this branch to points twist fields, because it's where everything was initially defined and somehow the object is fixed. And after that, well, we have done a lot of work on entanglement measures using concepts that originated in this paper and extending them and modifying them. And a couple of years later, we wrote a review, which is a little bit more extensive, and that's also a good reference. By the way, Benjamin Doyon, which is my main collaborator in this field, is also sitting here today, so you can also ask him questions. And the second part of my talk is going to be about something a little bit more recent, which is a paper that actually appeared today, finally. I don't know why it's emphasized like that, maybe because I was so excited that it appeared today. But it's a paper we've been working on for a little while with Benjamin and also another collaborator, Davide Fioravanti, from the University of Bologna. And it's a paper about how similar types of fields to those we study in those original works play also a role in the context of string theory and the computation of Wilson loops. So the first half is going to be about reviewing some results on measures of entanglement, and hopefully the second half will be about these conical twist fields, this new work. So, I should thank the people I have worked with in this field, which are, well, Benjamin, David already mentioned, and a few other people that will, and John Cardi in the first paper, and there are some other former students of mine and some other people we've worked with along the way. So, I told you this would be basic. So the first statement is very basic about what entanglement is. So the previous speaker already showed us quite a few formulas about entanglement entropy and CFT and so on. But I'd like to spend a couple of minutes just setting up the notation and the context for the talk, let's say. So you all know what entanglement is, and you also know very well that if you take a very simple state like a Bell state, you can tell straight away, if you know a bit of quantum mechanics, that this is a maximally entangled state, because by measuring the first spin, you know everything about the second. And equally, if I take another similar looking but very different state like this one, also, if you know a bit of quantum mechanics, you will immediately see that this is a state that's not entangled at all. So if you look at the first spin, you still have learned nothing about the second one. The probabilities are 50-50. So when you just have two spins or 2 degrees of freedom, it is very easy, without doing any calculation really, to differentiate states that have a lot of entanglement from those that have none. But what people have been busy studying for quite a while now, in many different areas, information theory, quantum field theory, string theory, is what happens if you try to generalize this intuitive idea of what entanglement is to much more complicated states, of course. And these are generally the states of many-body quantum systems. So, for example, you can think of a quantum spin chain with lots of these spins, many of them, hundreds or millions of them. What is a good measure of the entanglement in such a system? And in the end, especially in my work, what we are interested in is actually the case when there are infinitely many of those spins. So the scaling limit, conformal field theory, or quantum field theory more generally. So can we say something about entanglement there? And of course, we know that we can. But we have to find mathematical functions that provide a good measure of entanglement. And people have studied many such measures. There are lots of them in the literature. There is a good review by Pleni and Birmani where actually they kind of reviewed all these different measures of entanglement, talk about their main properties. But if you want to have a good measure of entanglement, there are some very basic properties that stand out and that you clearly want to have. One property that is very often mentioned, is that you want entanglement measures to be an entanglement monotone. So essentially, you want them to be functions, which essentially, when they return bigger values, that should reflect the fact that there's more entanglement in that state. And when they return smaller values, there should be less entanglement. And in particular, they should also be insensitive to certain operations. If you do something to the state, some operation which is a local operation or a classic or classical communications, there are certain modifications of the state that shouldn't increase the entanglement. There are also some other very basic requirements. You wouldn't like these measures of entanglement to be sensitive to unitary transformations. And in particular, you would like to be able to tell apart the two states I showed you at the beginning. So you want to have some function that really gives you the value zero if your state is separable, and some function that doesn't give you the value zero if it's not separable. Okay, so essentially that tells these two very simple examples apart. Now, these are very basic requirements, and if you look at this review, you will see that for most measures of entanglement, people require many other properties that are a little bit more complicated mathematically, but this is just some basic ones. Of all the measures of entanglement people have come up with, there are two I have worked on particularly, which are the bipartite entanglement entropy that was already mentioned before, and also I've done some work relating to logarithmic negativity, which also Giffre has worked on and has some very famous work on it. So these are good measures of entanglement according to this and some other properties. And today, because I want to not spend all my talk on this, I just want to review some results that we obtain and other people obtain for the first one, which is probably the best known, the entanglement entropy. In 1+1 dimensional quantum field theory, both at criticality and away from criticality. Okay, so let's just look at the definition
The four conditions that you have there, logarithmic negativity, and negativity is an upper bound on the disturbable entanglement. It doesn't satisfy condition four. You can have bound entangled states which have zero negativity.
Okay, I didn't know that. Take note, I'll remove that one from the list. Okay, so actually, so you're saying that you can have, with the negativity, can you repeat that? You can
have. Negativity is an upper bound on the disturbable entanglement.
All right.
As far as I know, nobody's found a counterexample yet.
Okay.
Giffre showed that in his initial paper that it's an upper bound.
Yeah.
And there's the types of entanglement which are not disturbable, which are called bound entanglement.
Okay.
And they have zero negativity, so when you do the partial transposition test on them, you get a positive eigenspectrum, but they are demonstrably not separable.
Okay, so that's.
Condition four, you don't want to demand it necessarily.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Because there might be different aspects to entanglement.
Okay.
That you may need the entanglement to create that state, but you may not be able to extract. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay. No, but it's important. Yeah. Okay. No, it's an important thing to know. I have given this talk many times. Nobody ever noticed it, so I think not many people know that. All right. So anyway, I'm not talking about negativity, which is good. I'm talking about entanglement entropy. So let me just give the very basic definition that you probably all know. So a good starting point is to think of spin chains always, because it's a lot easier to think of the degrees of freedom in there. And in the one of the simplest setups to compute entanglement entropy is just the setup where you divide the system into two parts, and each of these parts is connected. So it's the simplest situation. So you have subsystem A and the rest, and you can even think this, there are periodic boundary conditions. So you are on a circle, so you don't have to worry about the boundaries. So you can define an entanglement entropy for this, a von Neumann entanglement or bipartite entanglement. And if you're looking at a simple state, like a ground state, which is a pure state, phi, then you just define your reduced density matrix in the usual way, and you have your von Neumann entropy, which will be a function of the number of spins in here, or the length of this subsystem. Now, there is another type, other types of entanglement entropies people study a lot, and one that is very popular is the Reinie entropies. So quite a few people here will be familiar with those. And in the Reni entropies, I mean, the definition is kind of similar. It involves also this reduced density matrix here. But now it appears in this configuration. So you have a trace of rho A, but it's now raised to a power. And this power gives you another parameter that parameterizes these Reni entropies. Now, Reni entropies are interesting for many reasons, and they have very nice properties. But one property that you have in particular is that if you are able to compute all these Reni entropies for any n, and you are able to compute this limit here when n approaches 1, you should get the von Neumann entropy. Now, mathematically, it's very easy to see why that's the case. It's just taking a limit. But in quantum field theory, this sort of recipe, which people sometimes call the replica trick, is quite powerful. And it's powerful for the reason that in quantum field theory, actually, there is a rather natural and nice interpretation for this trace of rho to the n, as long as n is a positive integer. Okay, so that has a special meaning in QFT. Okay, now what meaning does it have? This is already also quite an old story, and already in the original papers where people did these computations of entanglement in CFT, like Kahle and Wilczek and so on, they realized that this trace of rho to the n can be interpreted as a partition function in QFT. And it's a partition function, but it's a partition function on a particular geometry, which is an n-sheeted Riemann surface. And that's why that n, it is important that it's integer, which is because it's counting the number of sheets in the Riemann surface. So to have a proper normalization, usually people divide by the partition function of the original model raised to the power n, just to ensure that when n goes to 1, this goes to 1. So the sort of picture of this, if you wish, is that when you do this rho to the n, every one of these matrix elements, you can think of it as living on the complex plane, where you now have a hole or a branch cut, which results from having traced out those degrees of freedom over subsystem A. So there's some space in there. And when you do the power n, well, it's like multiplying many of these together. The sort of geometric configuration that emerges out of that is that, well, every consecutive product that you do, you are connecting the state on the right-hand side here with the next state on the left-hand side and so on. And from the point of view of the Riemann surface, that means connecting the lower part of the branch cut to the upper part of the next branch cut, and so on. And at the end, you're taking a trace. So what you're doing at the end is connecting the last sheet to the first one cyclically. So you have a Riemann surface with n sheets that are cyclically connected. Okay. In the QFT language, trace of rho to the n is proportional to this partition function on this Riemann manifold. Okay, now this interpretation of this object was very useful in these works here. In all of these papers, it was used because it turns out that in particular in this situation where you have a single branch cut in the middle, and if you're looking at a conformal field theory, so if you are a criticality, you can actually use conformal invariants to map this Riemann surface back to the complex plane, just with the not just the complex plane, but the complex plane where you have two punctures, or two points where you have conical singularities. So you have two points where there is, when you go around, actually you go around by 2 pi n rather than 2 pi. Okay? So there is a conformal map that does that for you. And as a result, you can actually compute this partition function, okay, at critical points in a relatively easy manner. Okay, and from that computation follow very famous results for the entanglement in CFT that you're going to see in a minute. Now, the idea that you can use conformal maps is very good in CFT, but even in CFT has its limitations, because if you have more complicated geometry, for example, if your region A is not just a single cut, but is several, so you have multiply disconnected regions, then the sort of Riemann surfaces that emerge are more complicated, and they cannot be mapped back to the Riemann sphere or the complex plane. So in those cases, even using conformal maps is not sufficient to compute the partition function. But if you are away from criticality, which is a situation we have particularly studied ourselves, then again, conformal maps is not something that you can use. So you have to have some way of accessing this partition function if you want to do some calculation. Okay, so that way of accessing the partition function are these branch point twist fields that I'll be coming to in a minute. So another issue that emerges is that even if you are able to compute this partition function, remember that if you want to compute the von Neumann entropy, you have to take this limit at the end. And we just saw in this picture that having an integer is quite crucial to the whole picture. So even if you can compute the partition function, you have to mathematically understand how to do that analytic continuation in N. And that is a problem that is actually not universally solved. It's not universally understood how to solve it. But we managed to solve it, at least for some particular class of theories. We understood how to do that. So the analytic continuation is not solved in general, although the existence and the uniqueness of that analytic continuation are expected. And in many cases, they can be established under certain natural conditions. And one such natural condition that is often used and that we used is something called Carlson theorem. And this is a theorem that tells you something about, well, under which conditions the analytic continuation of some function whose value you know for a finite number of integer values of n, in this case, well, under which conditions you're going to have a unique analytic continuation. And the condition mainly is that the function should not diverge too fast at infinity and so on. So there is some technicalities there. Obviously, this is a difficulty when you try to do computations analytically using QFT methods. If you are doing numerics, usually it's not a problem because, of course, as long as you know what the reduced density matrix is and you know its eigenvalues, you can compute any powers of those eigenvalues in principle, whether they are integer or not. So in that case, you can compute von Neumann entropy or Rényi entropies for any n. It's not a problem. OK, so this is about replica trick. So let me show you now a couple of results, one of which you will know for sure because it came up in the previous talk, and one which perhaps you won't know so much, which is a result that we obtained. So this is a slide about Rényi and von Neumann entropies at critical points and away from critical points. And these are all things that are known for a while. So we already saw that in the previous talk. Already we saw, although we saw it a little bit more specialized, but essentially you all know that if you are at a critical point in two dimensions for that particular setup, the entanglement entropy diverges logarithmically. We discussed that just a minute ago. There is a non-universal cutoff that was also discussed before and which you can relate to the spacing on the spin chain if you wish. And it's a non-universal number. And then in front of that, if you're looking at the Rényi entropies, you're going to have some standard dependency on n. And then in front of that n, what is important is that there is some universal quantity that appears. And that's the main reason why this entanglement entropy has become so famous and so interesting to study in QFT. And that number that appears there is usually the central charge of the CFT. But if you think of slightly more general types of conformal field theories that we studied recently, namely theories that are non-unitary in a certain sense, then that C generalizes to another universal number. It's called the effective central charge. Okay? So this is essentially the same C we saw in the previous talk. So what is really nice in here is that this is really universal. It doesn't depend on the cutoff. It's really a number that it characterizes your theory in a rather unique way. So if you want to look at more than one interval in here, then things are much more complicated. There are no simple formulas like this, as you would expect. But what people know is that whatever the entanglement entropy is going to depend not just on the central charge, but it's going to depend on the whole operator content of your conformal field theory. So it's going to be a much more complicated object, but it's going to give you a lot of information about the underlying CFT. Now, what happens if you are near criticality? So you are not at infinite correlation length, you have a finite correlation length. Well, it's also known what happens in that case. And as far as I know, I think it was actually in the famous paper of John Cardin, Pasquale Calabrese in 2004, that they stated and they showed by some simple argument that if you have a theory that is gapped, that is not critical, then the entanglement entropy is going to saturate to some maximum value. And that maximum value is a function of the correlation length. Essentially, in fact, that maximum value, this is the von Neumann entropy now, so there is no n in here, but that maximum saturation value is essentially the same value the entropy will take at the critical point where the length is now replaced by the correlation length. Okay? So the picture is rather clear. If your correlation length is much smaller than the length of your subsystem, at some point you accumulate a maximal amount of entanglement that it cannot grow anymore. Now, however, there is actually a situation in between. So essentially, if the correlation length is finite, but it's still much larger than your interval, what you will see is something that looks like CFT, still. And if you're in the opposite regime, when psi is very small compared to the length of your interval, you have saturation. But what happens if you are in a situation where your correlation length and the length of your interval are of the same order of magnitude? So you're not in any of these two limits. Then essentially, there's going to be a crossover between these two behaviors. There's going to be a transition between the logarithmic divergence, the logarithmic scaling of CFT and the saturation of QFT. And what we managed to work out using these branch point twist fields in our original paper was we work out a description of this transition. So essentially, we showed that if you subtract the saturation value of the four Neumann entropy, which will be this value here when L goes to infinity, you subtract it from the entropy, what remains is going to be, well, a number of corrections to that behavior. And the leading correction of them all is going to look exactly like this. It's going to be characterized by a Bessel function, which involves the mass of the lightest particle in the spectrum of your QFT. So that means several things. One is that actually you can get information about the spectrum of your theory, if it's massive, by looking at this particular measure of entanglement, which is a rather nice thing. And it's possible to really see this decay here very clearly by doing numerics on various spin chains, which is something we did a little bit later, just to check that that works. So you have corrections like that. Something that was surprising to us, and I think is quite interesting still, although that's an old result now, is that this is so universal. So this -108 Bessel function is really a result that is true for any 1+1 dimensional QFT. Not any particular theory, all theories, it will look like this. So whether you have the Ising model or the Singe-Gordon model or any other model, your leading term is going to be a term like that. Okay, so this is quite remarkable. And the fact that it is so universal, it really is a consequence of how this analytic continuation in N is performed. After you take N to 1, essentially something very universal about the entropy is captured, which doesn't depend on the details of the theory very much, but just has this form. So exponentially decaying corrections. There are similar calculations that can be done actually for the logarithmic negativity, which we did more recently. And again, one also finds these sort of crossover behaviors between the conformal behavior and the full massive QFT behavior. And they are also characterized by these Bessel functions with different arguments depending on the mass scale. Okay? So these are some results. Now, I would like to tell you a little bit how these results are obtained, not the technical details, which are quite long, but at least tell you about where these branch point twist fields play a role. Essentially, the way this Bessel function is obtained is by using a branch point twist field calculation. Okay, so let's go back to that.
In that expression, why is the result not proportional to the central charge in any way? So if I had two copies of the same theory, I would expect twice as much entropy.
If you had two copies, you will have twice as much because you will have twice this lightest particle in there. So this will get multiplied by 2 automatically.
There should be the number of lightest particles.
Well, yeah. So if there are, yeah, there should be actually, yeah. So if you have more than one lightest particle, I mean, you have the number in there.
So
okay.
The
yeah.
Twice.
It will be twice, yes. Sorry. So actually, there should be a number of lightest particles in there. So it depends. So in that sense, it depends a bit on your theory. So when we did numerics, for example, one of the theories we looked at was the XXZ chain in the gapped regime. And in that regime, this NQFT corresponds to the Singe-Gordon model, which has two lightest particles, a soliton and an antisoliton. And when you do the numerics in the chain, indeed, you get a quarter here. So you see those two particles being present. So the degeneracy of the spectrum it plays a role in there. Other things? Okay, so let's go to the branch point twist field. So how is this result obtained? Well, at criticality, as I said, you can use conformal maps to get some of your results, and you can sometimes be lucky and compute those partition functions. But if you have not at criticality, you need some other technique. And this technique of using some kind of field to represent measures of entanglement actually also originates from this paper of Calabrese and Cardi in 2004. And as far as I know, I think they were the first people that suggested that this entanglement entropy, even at criticality, could be represented as a two-point function of some kind of field. And in that paper, they described that field as a field associated to branch points on multi-sheeted Riemann surfaces. They used this representation to do some calculation. Later on, we kind of thought about this field a little bit more closely, and we characterized it in a slightly different way. So we found an interpretation of these fields, which is a little bit more natural in QFT, and you can think of them as symmetry fields in a QFT replica model. So that's how we characterized them in that paper. So what does this mean? Well, essentially, suppose that you have a certain QFT for which you want to compute some measure of entanglement. The first thing you're going to do is to create n copies of that QFT. So that's where the replica element emerges. And this is directly connected to this n-sheeted manifold picture I had earlier. So you have n non-interacting copies of your theory, okay, whatever your theory was. But once you have this new QFT with many replicas, automatically, because of the way it was created, this new QFT has a huge amount of symmetry. And in particular, it has a very clear symmetry and the cyclic permutation of all these replicas, because all of these copies are identical to each other. And whenever we have an internal symmetry in QFT, we normally have a twist field associated to that symmetry. And so the twist field that emerges here is what we call this branch point twist field. So it's a twist field associated to replica permutation symmetry, cyclic permutation symmetry, and it is the origin of some branch cut. So it's a branch point twist field. So how do we characterize that model? Well, suppose that we now restrict ourselves a little bit to have something a bit more simple. So suppose that we have now an integrable theory in 1+1 dimensions. So it's a QFT. But it's a QFT where the scattering processes between particles can be fully characterized by two-particle S matrices. So this SAB is the two-particle S matrix, the scattering between two particles. And in two dimensions, you can characterize that fully in terms of a single variable, which is this rapidity, theta. Now, if you build n copies of this model, essentially your new S matrix is going to be something like this. It's going to be an S matrix with two indices, as before. By the way, if you... In this case, you assume your theory is diagonal as well. And what this means is that whenever two particles scatter, the same two particles come out of that scattering. So you only have two labels in each S matrix. So when you do your n copies, your new S matrix is going to look something like this in these non-interacting copies. It's going to have indices, mu1, mu2. And each of these indices is actually two indices. One index A or B is going to label the particle type, the particle species. So maybe in your original QFT, there were eight particle species, so they have their labels. And the I and the J, and they're going to label the copy number, because now you have n copies. So essentially, your S matrix is the same you had at the beginning. Whenever the particles live in the same copy, you have the standard S matrix. Whenever they live in different copies, the S matrix is one, so they don't see each other. Okay, that's the scattering matrix underlying this replica theory. So, n non-interacting copies. So this is the theory into which you can now introduce these twist fields. And then now these twist fields, they just implement this cyclic permutation symmetry in your theory. And one way to represent that is just by some exchange relations, such as this. So in these equations here, this phi represents some field of the QFT. For example, suppose it's the fundamental field. So it's the field that creates the particles in the QFT, or one particle type at least. Now this field will have some index because there will be a copy of this field for each of the theories. We have n of them. And the statement is that whenever this field, I think they have a picture here, which makes it a bit easier to see. So whenever this field takes a trip around the twist field, because this twist field has this branch cut associated to it, or this twist property, if you wish, whenever this branch cut is crossed, the field phi I emerges as the same field, but in one copy above, okay, in the copy I plus one. So if they are exchanged in a certain direction, the field changes copy. If they are exchanged in the other direction without crossing the branch cut, then nothing happens. Okay, so this is the basic rule. And then you can also, of course, define a conjugate twist field, which is going to do the reverse permutation operation. So it's going to bring things down along the copies instead of up. This is T tilde in our notation. And by using these two fields, essentially, you can represent many, at least the logarithmic negativity and the And the entanglement entropy can be represented now in terms of correlation functions of these fields. So essentially, the whole complexity of this n-sheeted Riemann surface that we had earlier gets encoded into the non-trivial properties that these fields have in QFT. Now, something that we did a few years later was to find a representation of these fields in the context of spin chains. So if you have a discrete system, a quantum spin chain, you can also find a representation of these operators in terms of local operators on the chain. So there are also calculations that can be done there. And one thing that is worth saying is that actually we were really not the first to come across these fields, not at all. These fields actually had been studied a lot in the context of orbifold CFT, which was a very active field of research in the 80s. So in fact, Kinishnik, Dixon, and others had already studied these fields and had actually computed the conformal dimensions much earlier than us or Carri Calabrese that kind of found it again without realizing it was there. So this is the conformal dimension of both T and T tilde. It's a function of the replica number and it's a function of C. Okay? And obviously when n goes to 1, this goes to 0 because if you don't have any copies, you don't have twist field. The twist field is the identity in that case. So it has dimension 0 and that's consistent. All right. Okay, so that's the definition. Now, once you have this definition, it's very easy to check that many of the results I showed you earlier can be very easily derived just from this construction. And I'm gonna show you just three examples of this sort of twist field measures of entanglement dictionary. So my first example is the one-point function of twist field. So this epsilon here is always this non-universal cutoff that appears in my formulae. But essentially, the one-point function of the twist field in a QFT essentially is going to represent the entanglement entropy between two semi-infinite regions. So if you take your spin chain and just split it in two and you make it infinitely large, there is an entanglement associated to that, and that is related to the one-point function of this field. It's as if you inserted a single field here at the boundary, essentially. If you have the configuration I had earlier with the single interval, this corresponds to the two-point function of these twist fields. Okay? This will be a function of n, so that will give you the Reni entropy. And then once you have this two-point function, you will take the limit if you can, and you will get von Neumann entropy. Okay? It's very easy. In the case of critical points, we know it is exactly known how these two-point functions have to behave. They have a power law decay behavior. And if you know the dimensions of these fields, it's a one-line calculation to show that this gives you immediately this C over 6 logarithm of L over epsilon formula that we are all familiar with. And then if you have more complicated geometries, then you have higher and higher point functions to compute, and it gets pretty hard to do. So for example, if you have if you want to compute the entanglement entropy, the von Neumann entropy of two disconnected regions, so of A union B with respect to C, then this corresponds to computing this four-point function in here. And actually, nobody knows how to do this, even in CFT. So Calabrese, Cardi, and Tony have done a lot of work. Also, actually, Vincenzo, that is here, so I should mention him. Hi. So they have done a lot of analytical and numerical work to compute this four-point function just for the compactified free boson, which is a very particular case where this four-point function was known from before. But in general, these are really complicated objects, and I think even in CFT, it's not understood even how to do the analytic continuation from taking n to 1. Okay, so after these two examples, everything gets hugely complicated, okay, in terms of the computations. But lots of people have done lots of work on this. So this is, I think, So this is about these twist fields. Now, how do you actually compute things with them more precisely? Okay, I should accelerate a bit. So you want to compute many point functions. Well, the way people do this in 1+1 dimensional QFT usually is by representing these correlation functions, this one or that one, in terms of matrix elements, matrix elements of the individual fields that appear here. And these matrix elements are usually called form factors. So in 1+1 dimensional QFT, there is a whole program of work that many people have worked on since the 70s, which is really dedicated to computing matrix elements of local operators in QFT. Okay, and the twist field is another local operator in the replica theory. So you can use that program to compute those building blocks of correlation functions. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that, in particular because we will then compare it to the same program for the other field that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk. So what is a form factor? So it's a matrix element, and usually it's a particular type of matrix element, something like this. So essentially you characterize your states in 1 plus 1 dimensional QFT by the rapidities of the particles in the state. And if this is an incoming state, you can imagine you have a bunch of particles coming in. And then you have some local operator. And these particles can carry also some quantum numbers from mu1 to mu k. So k particle form factor is this kind of matrix element in here. Okay, and I'm going to represent it by a drawing, something like this. And this red line is going to represent this branch cut emerging from this field, if it's a twist field. Okay? Now, these form factors are building blocks, correlation functions. Hopefully, you can all see that. But for example, if you compute a two-point function of a field with its conjugate, what is going to be represented as is an infinite sum over the moduli squared of these objects here, okay, essentially. And then there will be some dependency on the distance between the operators as well. But OK, you can do that computation. It's you can rarely compute the whole sum, but you can compute the first few terms. And OK, there's lots of technical details in there. But if you know these form factors, at least you have a starting point. And in fact, in integral QFT, it is known that these sorts of objects are solutions of what is normally called a Riemann-Hilbert problem. They've been computed for many theories, and they were originally studied by these people here. So for a very long time, this is really an old subject in a way. Now, what this means, this Riemann-Hilbert problem, it means that because you are in if you are in an integral QFT, there are so many constraints, so many symmetries, that actually you can fully compute these form factors by solving some equations. Okay, and you can compute them exactly. Now, those equations are of two types. There is some of them will tell you about the monodromy properties of this function, so their periodicity properties if you exchange rapidities or if you shift rapidities. And some others will tell you about the pole structure of these form factors. So they will tell you what happens if two rapidities differ by I pi, there will be some kinematic pole, what is the residue of that pole, etc. So let me show you those relatively quickly and using pictures. So, for example, the first equations, they're called Watson's equations. They just tells you that if you exchange two particles in the form factor, now we are talking about the twist field in here. So I should say that actually in this program I mentioned here was for local fields, but it was for fields which are a bit more simple than the twist field. So when we did our work on twist fields, we had to generalize those equations a little bit. Okay, so these are the ones I'll show you. And what I was saying is that if you exchange two particles in here, you just pick up an S matrix. And this is equivalent to sort of looking at this picture in here. You just exchange two particles, you get a form factor still, but there is an S matrix in front. Something a little bit less trivial is what happens when you go around the operator here. So if you do a rotation by 2 pi I, or you take this particle on a trip like this, what happens is that you're going to cross the branch cut in here, and because of the special properties that this twist field has, the particle will emerge as a particle of the same species, but living on a copy above. Okay, so it's going to change its index, and that's represented by a hat in there. So that gives you two conditions that these functions must satisfy. And then you have two others, actually, that emerge, which relate to their polar structure. These are called kinematic residue equations. And okay, let me show to you in a picture. And sorry that this picture is different in style. This is from our original paper, so we represented the field a bit differently. But again, this is our twist field with this branch cut. And essentially, the kinematic residue equation, the first one tells you that if you have two particles in here, and one is the antiparticle, which are of the same type, and you shift one by I pi, so you actually rotate it to the other side, these two particles can annihilate on the left-hand side of the twist field. And the result of this annihilation is that you get a form factor of the rest of the particles that are left. And you have a number here, I, which is the residue of that operation, okay, of that pole. And but there is another way in which this can happen. This is the other equation, which is that You could have two particles initially, which live in different copies of the theory. One is above the other. And then you take this one, the second one, across all of the others. So you get lots of S matrices in there from the interactions. And then when it gets to the end, you bring this one to the other side and you may then annihilate as well. And in that case, you also have a kinematic pole associated to that. And this is represented by this equation here. Okay? Now, I know this is a bit fast if you never saw it before, but hopefully it gives you an idea of how you go about solving this sort of thing. So if you look at these equations, in fact, you see that they relate k plus 2 to k particle form factors. So they give you actually a recursive relation that allows you to solve for higher particle form factors from the lower particle ones. And this is essentially how this is solved, really. You start by solving for 0, for 1, for 2, and then you use these equations recursively. So it's complicated. It depends how complicated it is, depends on the theory. And in fact, for the twist field, the only theories for which all of these form factors are known are free theories, the free fermion and the free boson. Yeah?
Sorry, do these two equations mean that the right-hand side of both the equations are same?
Because both of them are looking at the same residue of the same pole, right?
Sorry?
So the form factor on the left in both equations is the same, right?
Yes, this is the same one, yes.
On the left?
On the right. On the right is the same. On the left is not the same because this one involves two particles which are just antiparticle of each other, but they live on the same copy. And in here, you have two particles that are antiparticle of each other, but one of them is on the copy above from the other. So it has a hat. This hat here represents that it lives on the copy above. And you need that because if they annihilate here, this one will have to cross the branch cut to meet the other one. And so only then they will really be annihilating, seeing each other. Okay? So that's why this kinematic equation divides into two equations. Okay, for normal fields, actually, it's a single one. All right? Okay, so these are the equations. So what's the summary? I mean, once you have these equations and you learn how to solve them, you can use these form factors as your building blocks to compute correlation functions, and you can learn things about entanglement, and you can do computations, and all of these computations will give you functions that depend on n. And actually, they depend on n quite critically because remember, n is essentially counting the number of particles in the spectrum is proportional to n, okay? So in all the calculations you do, you always have this n present, and you always have sums from 1 to n, summing over all these copies. And then eventually, you have to come up with a method to really do this analytic continuation when n goes to 1. And this is rather tricky, so I'm not going to show you that today, but you can find it in our papers. But this was quite a important result for us that we could do that. And this is how that Bessel function I showed you earlier actually comes about. In the end, it all becomes very simple, but the calculation is not really that simple. Okay? So let me leave it here for the branch point twist fields so you get an idea what they are and how they are used. And now let me go to the second part, which is these other twist fields. Okay? And about these twist fields, I have to confess, I still know very little. I know what I have done, of course, but I know very little about the context in which they are used. So this is something I'm still learning, and I think many of you here will know more than me. So I apologize in advance if some of what I say is not exactly precise. So a few years ago, in 2014, we found out, actually from John Cardi, I think he wrote to us and said, oh, I just went to a talk by Pedro Vieira, and they are saying that these twist fields appear in the context of Wilson loops and in super young Mills theory and in a very different context from entanglement, nothing to do with it. And so we looked at the paper, and this is actually the abstract of that paper that is written there. So in that abstract, they say we consider the collinear limit of gluing scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 super young Mills theory. Okay, so completely different thing at strong coupling. And we argue that in this limit, scattering amplitudes in super young Mills map into correlators of twist fields. In a two-dimensional theory, which is a nonlinear sigma model, it's an integrable model, O6, and these are similar to those that appeared in recent studies of the entanglement entropy. Okay, and they mentioned our work, so we were very happy. But we didn't quite understand how these fields that they had, I mean, why they were the same as ours, or if they were the same as ours, it wasn't quite clear. So, at the time, we didn't quite understand why it was so similar. We forgot about it. And then, last year, we went on a sabbatical to the University of Bologna. We met Davide Fioravanti in there. And then he was very keen in understanding that, and together we came to some understanding. So this is the paper that we just finished now. So this is a picture also from that same paper, okay? And well, in this picture, they're trying to represent some sort of Wilson loops. So these Wilson loops are some objects that have some amplitudes associated to them. And these objects are related to scattering amplitudes in this Super Young-Mills theory. And this, in this case, what they are trying to represent here, I think, is that if you have a square, okay, you can kind of extend that square by adding some extra angle at this corner and that corner. And the way this additional excess angle is introduced is by putting some kind of twist field in there, some conical singularity that increases the angle at that point in space. So that that hexagon, that square, gets transformed technically into a hexagon. And then there is also a picture that emerges from their work where this hexagon in some way is related to having two pentagons that you fuse together. So if you take two pentagons and you glue together along one line, essentially you get a hexagon, okay? Now, I mean, I know this, I mean, I'm saying all of this without context, but this is a rather natural language in the context in which this appears. So, okay. More precisely, what do they claim or what did they find? Where, what they observed was something like this. So they found that there were some fields that are important in the computation of these Wilson loops. And at critical points, they observed that these fields satisfy some kind of OPE. Okay, and this conformal OPE looks like that. So they have some field which they associate with this pentagon I was talking about, so hence the label here. And when two of these pentagonal fields come close together, there is a power law decay with some power A. There is also some logarithm in there. So somehow the conformal field theory they look at seems to be a logarithmic CFT, or there are logarithms involved with some other power. And then there is another field that appears here, which in their context they associate with this hexagon. So essentially two pentagons give hexagon. Now what's interesting, what was quite remarkable for us, is that all of these fields here, they have a dimension, and their dimension is exactly the same as the dimension of the branch point twist field. So that really strongly suggested that they must be related, or maybe they are the same. And actually, in their paper, more or less, they suggest that they must be the same field, because they have many things in common. Okay, the fact that these dimensions here are really this one for some particular values of n was also then checked numerically by other people. Now, this is very good, but what is slightly confusing for us, and was confusing for us, is that although this dimension is the same, the values of n, which matter in this context, are always non-integer values of n. So the field that they call pentagonal field has a value of n which is 5/4. The field that they call hexagonal field has a value of n which is 3/2. Okay, so these are non-integer values of n. They are fractional. And this n is related in their context to, in that setup, is related to something that is called an excess angle. So every time you put a field in a space, it creates an additional, when you go around it, you have a conical singularity. So when you go around, instead of going around by 2 pi, you go around by 2 pi plus some additional value, alpha, which is related to that n in there. Okay? But in all of this story, there is no notion of having a replica. And of course, there couldn't be, because you cannot have 5/4 copies of something, okay? So clearly, there were some conceptual differences between these two fields, but for a while, we didn't really know what the main differences were, and then we had some idea, okay? So what do we think these fields are? Well, so from all of the things I told you so far, you remember the branch point twist field is related to an internal symmetry of the QFT. Internal symmetry, which is permutation symmetry. And that is there because of the replica story. Now, in this case, there's no replica. So how can you have a twist field in there that has the properties that is supposed to have here? Well, one way that you can define that twist field a little bit more formally is to think that it is a field associated with an external symmetry. Not an internal symmetry of the theory, but an external space-time symmetry of the theory. And the symmetry in this case is actually rotation symmetry. So essentially, what this field does is to introduce an additional angle into space. So this has to do with rotation symmetry. So it's a symmetry of rotation about a point. So these are fields that induce a conical singularity of an arbitrary excess angle alpha, which is related to n in these ways, 2 pi n minus 1, where this n is not necessarily an integer in this case. Okay. So what do they do, more or less? I mean, this is a picture. We have called them like that. So this is a field. It's associated with some alpha, which is this excess angle. And it sits at some point in a space. And when some other field, in particular, tries to go around it, when it gets to the original point, it kind of goes back by alpha. So this alpha is measured sort of clockwise direction. It gets here, it goes back by alpha, and then it has to move again by alpha to come back to the beginning. So going back to the same point is a rotation of 2 pi plus alpha, plus this excess angle. Okay? So you can define a field like that. And in our paper, what we did mainly was to give a rather rigorous definition of that field, at least at critical points. Okay, we could do that. And one way to represent that field is a formula like this. It's not entirely explicit, but more or less explicit. So here you would have this R represents the rotation current, so the neta current associated to rotation symmetry. Here you have some parameterization of actually the branch cut of this field that goes from 0 to infinity in that case. You have the excess angle alpha in there. And then to make sure that this is finite, you, especially at critical points, you have to have some regularization scheme to really have a proper definition of that field in CFT. And this is what is indicated by this epsilon here. So this is a kind of UV cutoff, which appears here 2 raised to the correct power of that field. And in our paper, we use this definition here to prove that this field, for example, has the correct conformal dimension that is claimed in the paper of Vieira and collaborators. And to find actually, in CFT, actually, you can write this rotation current instead in terms of components of the stress and yield tensor. So you can have something rather explicit, an explicit realization of the field. Okay, so this is what I just said. So the main result of our work was really to, well, give a characterization for this field, give a definition that is a little bit formal, but it allows us to do computations, at least in CFT, and to prove that it has the correct properties, in particular the correct dimension. And then what we did in addition is to check that against a form factor calculation as well for these fields. So something that it's interesting to note, to differentiate between this branch point twist field and this conical twist field, is in particular their conformal OPEs. So let me show you those just for a minute. So if you have two of these conical twist fields in here, you can have fields associated to different excess angles, alpha and alpha prime. And in principle, you can have those fields in the same theory. You could have a field sitting at some point in space that adds some angle alpha and some other field that adds an angle alpha prime. And because these fields induce a rotation, if you do an OPE of them, you will expect to get a field on the other side, which is the sum of the two rotations, alpha plus alpha prime. Now, this OPE here is a more general version of exactly the OPE that Pedro and his collaborators had found originally, where here they had pentagon, pentagon, hexagon. Well, that corresponds to alpha by half, alpha by half, alpha plus alpha prime is pi. So pi half is pentagon, and the excess angle of hexagon is pi. And that will give you the sort of power law that they had as well, what we call capital A in that formula. If you look at branch point twist field instead, it's a little bit different conceptually, because when you define branch point twist fields, the number n is fixed from the beginning. The number n tells you how many copies you have. So you cannot have OPEs of fields for different values of n. You can only have OPEs such as this here. So you can have T approaching its Hermitian conjugate to give the identity with the right power law. Or you can have twist field approaching itself. And in that case, you get another field, which is actually important in the context of logarithmic negativity, it turns out. This is called the field T squared. And this is also a twist field, but it's a twist field that generates permutation only amongst even labeled copies or odd labeled copies. So essentially it jumps by 2 every time. And it has some dimension, delta, but that dimension depends critically on whether the number of copies is even or odd. Okay? So these are, this is just to emphasize, these are different fields, but they still have similar properties. Yeah?
Is V of 2 pi just the identity?
V of 2 pi is the identity? I think it's not.
Oh.
Should it be?
V of 0. 0 is the identity.
V of 0. No, V of 2 pi is not, it will be, I mean...
You don't have any branches. I figured it's if you just rotate again by 2 pi, nothing will know about it. Well, maybe not, I don't know.
No, because 2 pi is the excess angle, so you would, I mean, if the excess angle is 2 pi, you would need to, I mean, every time you go around, you will go around by 4 pi rather than 2 pi. So it adds up.
Okay,
so
the, sure, but yeah. Does it, I see, okay.
Yeah,
but
so you still...
It still won't be the identity.
It still won't be the identity. So actually in the context of what Pedro and collaborators did, 4 pi, I think, is what they will call the octagon somehow. So it corresponds to some other kind of geometry of the Wilson loop. And I think it's non-trivial, as far as I understand. Okay, so yeah, I think I'm getting close. So you can stop me when you want. I think you're really quite tired. I wanted to to show you how the form factor equations change for these fields. So yeah, this is what I was saying before, that this is the case that they had considered in their work when the two when the two excess angles are exactly pi half. What we did was to, well, to have this explicit construction in CFT. And then what we tried to do, what we did was to compute this two-point function as well using a form factor program, similar to the one I showed you before for the branch point twist field. So you can also write down branch form factor equations for these fields in a very similar way as for the branch point twist field. They're just a little bit different, just because now every time you cross the branch cut, you don't change copy. There's no copy, but the rapidity is shifted by some angle, which is this excess angle. So these equations can be written down, and you can do then computations in particular of this two-point function. So I'm going to pass the equations fast, so not to tire you, because they are more or less the same. This is for integrable, let's see, QFT, yeah, integrable case, because, yeah, this is the only case for which we can write these form factor equations. So actually, something that happens and can be seen from the structure of those equations is that in the end, if you look at the equations for this field, it turns out that these are exactly the same equations as for the branch point twist field, but only if you only look at particles living in a single copy of the theory. So with the branch point twist field, you had many copies, but if you only are interested in the form factors of everyone living on copy one, actually those form factors are the same as for this field in here. And it's actually easy to see why that is the case if you look at their properties. So once you compute those form factors, you can compute this two-point function, and you can look at how it behaves at short distances. So even if you have a massive QFT, you can look at short distances, and you can try and find this power here, so this or this coefficient here. This coefficient here is going to characterize the power law in CFT of this two-point function. And this is something that we did. And I just have two pictures, and that is the end. So I'm not giving you more details. But the fact that we can get this is actually quite remarkable from a technical point of view. So let me tell you what is here. So what is plotted here is actually the value of this x. Okay. So there's a log in there. So if you remove the log, that will give you the behavior of the two-point function goes like 1 over x raised to the power of that x. Okay. So that's the power law when you approach these two fields together. So x is represented here, and what is represented is here two cases. One of them is when alpha and alpha prime are equal, okay, but generic, and this is plot against n. So alpha and alpha prime is 2 pi n minus 1, and here's an example where alpha and alpha prime are different. Okay, in both cases, you get the right thing. And the blue dots, they represent a free fermion theory, a massive free fermion, and the red dots correspond to a massive free boson. And I mean, you actually always see that this is essentially twice, the red is twice the blue, because the central charge of the free boson is 1 and free fermion is a half. And all the dimensions of these fields are proportional to C. So that's why you have that. But what's interesting here is that there are some solid lines underneath all these points. And those solid lines are the conformal prediction for this power law. So essentially, they are this formula I showed you here, this power. Okay, so exactly that power in there. It's known from CFT because the dimensions of these fields are known. And so you know what you should expect. And these are the solid curves underneath. And the dots on top, exactly on top, these are the values that you get from a form factor expansion. for these fields. So that gives you a very strong indication that you have the right form factors with the right properties, and that this is the right field, and that indeed the dimensions of these fields are the correct ones, and that the ones that Vieira and collaborators had originally identified, but here in a more slightly more general, for any excess angle, that that seems to work very well. Okay, so from a technical point of view, the fact that this works so well is for us quite remarkable, because although this field is similar to a branch point to this field, in terms of computations, it's very different. So in a branch point to this field, you have sums over copy numbers, you have analytic continuation you have to perform. Here you just have n entering as a parameter, and yet the conformal dimension of the field that emerges is the same. So the fact that they are the same is really kind of surprising if you do this sort of computation. So let me just conclude with a little summary. So I guess from these two examples, you've seen that twist fields are a little bit everywhere. They play an important role in many contexts. One is in the computation of partition functions in complicated geometries, which are related to measures of entanglement, and also in the context of computing scattering amplitudes in non-trivial geometries, and in particular in Super-Yang-Mills theory for this conical twist field. So we have seen two applications here, and there are many open questions for us, really, to look into. On the entanglement side, well, there are lots of measures that we haven't tackled yet. As I told you earlier, going beyond two-point functions is really very complicated. Even in CFT, going to four-point functions and higher. But if we want to know more about more complicated partitions about entanglement, then we will have to tackle those problems. Another problem that people have been looking at already in CFT and numerically is what happens if you look at excited states rather than just the ground state of QFT, and this is something we are looking at. Something that we have been interested in also for a while is actually whether this sort of twist field approach has any kind of generalization to higher dimensions, because all of this is in 1 plus 1D and it works very nicely. Is there conceptually anything similar in higher dimensions? That would be nice. And for the conical twist fields, well, we personally have a lot to learn still, because they emerge in a field which we were really not familiar with, perhaps has shown in my talk. But it's rather interesting that they emerge in there and how they are defined. And we would like to really understand them better, the quantities that are of interest in the context of Wilson loops and Super-Yang-Mills theory, and perhaps do some computations there. And also, we have had some nice discussions with Pedro this week, where he told us a bit more about the state of the field and about other types of amplitudes that seem to really be very important at the moment, or objects which are called hexagonal form factors that appeared in the context of those sorts of problems. So we'd like to understand those in terms of these conical fields, if they have any application there. We don't know yet. But anyway, quite a bit to do. So thanks for coming, and that's all from me.
We have time for a question or two.
Yeah?
I didn't quite understand why you need the conformal symmetry to write B as an integral of the stress tensor. I mean, you always have rotational symmetry on, so.
Yeah, no, the expression, I think, is more general than just CFT. That is true. So this kind of representation as an integral of a current, I think that's general for QFT. I think what is particular to CFT, as far as I understand, and maybe Benjamin should answer because he was the one that did the computation mainly of this part, but I think what's particular for CFT is that you can have a better understanding of what this current looks like in terms of the components of the stress energy tensor. So you have a slightly more explicit realization, whereas when you have a massic theory, there will be mass terms in there.
So it's not just a stress tensor, but there's also an identity operator contribution to the current. Identity operator, so you have stress as a constant. Stress as a constant is a function. But it's not sufficient to define the field properly.
As a field that represents the conic vascularity with the right transmission property. That's something.
So you need this extra function, and that function is known in CFT, but not in massive QFT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, but it's true that, I mean, this representation is valid more generally. It's more about doing a practical computation with it. It's a little bit harder if you have a mass. Yeah.
If not, let's take the speaker again.
Okay, thank you.